if you're an attorney, what are you really good at doing? Well, you're good at winning lawsuits and you're good at bringing in earnings. You are not, by trade, a financial advisor or investment manager.
That's Cody Sanchez, founder and CEO of Contrarian Thinking.
You haven't spent your life in pursuit of the keeping. You've spent your life in pursuit of the earning. And so, of course, you're better at one than the other.
I'm Michael Mogul, founder and CEO of Crisp, the nation's number one law firm growth company. I've built my business through practice, not theory. Crisp started with just $500 to my name and has grown to over eight figures in revenue over the last few years, earning a spot on the Inc. 500 list of the fastest growing private companies in America. Our approach has been to take everything we've learned about generating massive growth within our own organization and help the country's most ambitious and committed law firm owners do the same for theirs. In each episode of this podcast, I sit down with innovative market leaders from the legal industry and beyond to learn from those who thrive in the face of adversity, challenge the status quo, and define what it means to be a true game changer. I sat down with Cody Sanchez to discuss why the key to all freedom is financial freedom, how to gauge whether you're cut out for entrepreneurship, and what criteria to evaluate when considering potential investments.
Number one is really profit and revenue, because people will forgive you a lot of things if you are highly profitable. People will not forgive you anything if you lose money, but you have a ton of standard operating procedures and you have less risk because you don't have concentrated clients and you have a managerial level. So if you're trying to find the 20% that drives the 80%, it's profit.
That's coming up on the Game Changing Attorney Podcast. Before we begin today's episode, I want to remind you that we aren't beholden to any sponsors or run any ads on this podcast. This allows us to present all of our episodes raw and unfiltered. I'm not going to push any made-to-order meal services on you or try to save you any money on your car insurance. That being said, I have one small request. If you receive any value from this podcast, please give it a five-star review. Pay the fee so we can keep this podcast free. Cody, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this will be fun. This will be fun because you are a woman of many talents. I understand just your background between journalists, finance, investing, helping business owners. I want to get to that, obviously, but I'm just curious, like, how would you describe yourself when you were a kid? Were you entrepreneurial from an early age, or what were you like?
I didn't like the word no from an early age. I think, like a lot of entrepreneurs, it's a challenge against the world, right? And so that was always my idea, is that I wanted to push back on that word no. And that never really intrigued me very much, doing things the standard way, that's for sure.
And if you look back on that, obviously I'm wearing a shirt that says Built Not Born, and having two children of my own, this kind of reconciling this nature versus nurture, would you say that you were just born that way, or was that you were influenced somehow to be that way? Were there people in your life?
Who knows? I mean, long time ago, but my father was an entrepreneur. He was very concerned with, you know, building something that lasted, but according to his ethical and moral compass. So I'm sure that rubbed off on me. But yeah, I mean, my brother grew up in the same household and he's much more calm and collected than I am. So it goes back to that nature versus nurture, which I don't really know the answer to. I just know that, maybe some of us are just built a little different.
Yeah, I'm torn myself. I think the longer and longer that I do this, sometimes it's not to say that someone can't start a business. Obviously, anybody can start a business, but then there are some that I think are just born with certain traits and skills and personality styles that perhaps make them able to take on uncertainty better. That's probably what I would say. It flows with them a little bit easier than working against the grain.
Yeah, that makes sense.
If we go back to, let's say even undergrad, you get the Howard Buffett grant. You start your career as a journalist. I understand a conflict journalist. How do you go from conflict journalism to the work that you're doing today?
Well, it really started actually because I have this belief, which I'm sure we're going to talk about today, that the key to all freedom is actually financial freedom. And I think that if we don't have ownership, we cannot actually be free, which is why I'm obsessed with people getting to ownership in the lowest risk way possible. I think if you right now are an employee only, with only your salary, no investments, no ability for you to earn despite time tied to hours, that is hugely problematic. And so I think I saw that very early on when I was in Latin America, and I saw people who, just because of how much money they made and where they came from, they had a totally different life than I do. And now, I obsess on this idea of getting people into boring businesses and getting a community of humans together who are all learning about how to get ownership, because it doesn't really matter who you work for, how much money you make. As we've seen over the last year, you know, 279,000 jobs have been lost just in tech year to date. And so these are highly skilled people who thought that they were checking all the right boxes, and yet they lost everything. And so because of that, I think that people should own more assets, whether that's small businesses or real estate. I'm obsessed with people getting some ownership. And I think that started from seeing people who owned nothing, and thus the world exerted their will on them as opposed to the other way around.
Let's talk about that. I mean, just on the notion of financial freedom, how would you define it? Meaning that sometimes people have a number in their mind, but obviously this varies by person. This is more about just having options, right?
Yeah. So we have a community called Contrarian Community. And inside of that, we have something called the One Sheet. And the One Sheet basically defines financial freedom monetarily. So we like every single person to go through it. And we have multiple types of income. So we have one type of income, which is your vertical income. So that's the money you make in, let's say, your salary, your 9-to-5, or being the operator of your own business. Then you have your horizontal income, and your horizontal income is not tied to time. It can be tied to skills. It can be tied to assets and decisions that you've made, but you can earn in many different verticals that aren't tied only to you individually. And then we have sort of the third realm of this, which is we track for every single individual how much time freedom they have. So, you know, if you stopped working today, how much do you earn? And what does that compare to how much you make? And I think this is really, really important to track, because the only way to change something is to become really aware of what it is. And so definitionally for me, it's a number. Financial freedom is that you earn more than you need every single month, and you have a high degree of likelihood that you will continue to do that for the rest of the time that you will need to earn. And until you have that, I think you're just at more of a risk. And you can certainly have lifestyle inflation and all of those things, but I obsess on when people get in, I don't necessarily need every single person that comes into the group to buy a business, but I do need them to obsess on this financial freedom number, because if they do that, then I think you're a lot less easy to influence if you can be your own center of gravity from a monetary perspective.
Yeah. So we had a friend of yours, Bill Perkins, on the podcast, so author of Die with Zero. We talked about the FIRE movement, right? Financially independent, retire early. Yep. And I'm curious, when you discuss financial freedom, because there's different ways to this, right? So somebody could figure out, what do I live on, and try to cut every expense imaginable and just live their life on ramen noodles. And they could figure out that number, right? And then there's kind of the fat FIRE movement, where they talk about, you know, you want to be able to take trips and vacations and, you know, go out to eat and not have to stress about buying a flight. What is your stance on that?
I already know Bill's answer was not the FIRE movement, I anticipate. Listen, I think we were sold a lie about what a unicorn is. Lots of people told us that a unicorn was a high growth startup that eventually hit $1 billion, that changed the world, and that we are best suited in pursuit of this type of mythical creature. And that if we get it, we'll get on the cover of Forbes, we'll be rich and famous, we'll be happy. And in fact, the numbers tell us that no, instead, 95 to 98% of us will never hit that number, even close to it in any way, shape, or form. And we will just have spent years on couches, sleeping in garages, and not have actually built the thing and not have achieved true financial freedom. And so what I would say first is you don't need to chase unicorns in order to have financial freedom. Simultaneously, I do not think you need to live in a small cabin in the woods, having sold your car and grow all of your own vegetables, unless you're into that. I do think that we have a moral imperative to do everything we can with the skills and unique characteristics that we are each given to us. And so in my opinion, it's different for everybody, but try to see what your velocity speed is. Like, what could you actually accomplish? Because the problem is, even with a FIRE movement, okay, you've just lost a lot of optionality. So if nothing else, yes, you could live on a homestead. You could grow everything yourself until one negative impacting event happens to you. And three standard deviation events actually happen quite often. And so that's my issue, is that I want people to probably be a little bit more financially free than that book lends itself to. If anything, it would be the fat FIRE movement, which is like, how do you not get too much mimetic desire in order to want a bunch of stuff just because your neighbors have it? We all struggle with that. I struggle with that. And instead, have enough where you can be free and maybe exert your will on the world a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting, on the opposite end of this, let's say somebody who has built a fantastic business, they've accumulated a ton of wealth, and yet they're still on that hamster wheel. And they're saying the same things, like, I'm doing this for my family. And yet, you know, their family doesn't really know them. They're not really spending time with them. I guess my question then is, you know, when is enough enough?
First of all, I don't know why you can't integrate your family into the things that you build. Why is there this bizarre differentiation between time spent with family and time spent working? You know, most family time in the U.S. is actually spent in front of a television screen. And so is that better than actually bringing your kids and your husband or your wife into your business and you guys building something together and knowing what legacy looks like, but being able to see each other in pursuit of something? And so I would say, yeah. I mean, I don't think anybody at their deathbed goes, I wish I would have spent more time away from my family and working as opposed to with them. But simultaneously, I can't think of anything worse than a life spent sipping Mai Tais on the beach forever with no purpose in sight. That just to me seems like that would grow really old really quickly. You know, a month of that a year sounds pretty good. Anything past that, probably not. And in fact, the science actually tells us this. You know, increasingly, I was talking to Arthur Brooks yesterday, who has studied happiness for decades. And he basically said there's four things that drives happiness: friends, family, faith, and work that serves people. So if those four things are the key indicators in decades worth of research surrounding happiness, then I think that what that means is we just have to balance the four. And maybe the way to balance them is to integrate them as opposed to try to throw, you know, four balls up at once juggling. That seems relatively hard than just to mesh them all together into a bigger ball.
Yeah. We're kind of at a point in society where, you know, things can correct either way. So there was a whole movement around work-life balance. And this is a tough thing, right? Because there's environments where people don't want balance, right? They want to, in many ways, I think, have their nose to the grindstone. They want to achieve great things. And to them, balance, they don't equate like a 50-50 balance with happiness. And that, you know, it's trying to draw the line there. I mean, I guess societally, it may make people feel better, but that's not always what they want. What is your stance on that?
I'm definitely not the person you should follow if you want balance. I don't think that's part of my repertoire at all. But I do not also subscribe to this belief that we should have to sacrifice everything in order to achieve financial freedom. I actually think it's much more achievable than we were told, which is why I obsess on talking to people about M&A. Why would you not go out and buy a profitable business that has existed already for 10 years, that has a high likelihood of continuing to exist, that's profitable day one, and doesn't have a ton of volatility in it, has sort of like a natural 3-5% growth curve year over year, and take a bet on something that feels more like a bond than a stock? And that to me makes all the sense in the world, which is why I continue to push on it. Our goal is we want to create 1 million financially free humans and 100,000 small business owners. So I think in our group thus far, we've tracked about $262 million in profit bought in the last year and a half, and hundreds of small business owners who have bought businesses. So I kind of obsess on this idea of like, what tactically can we show? If I believe that the key to all freedom is financial freedom, that's what I want to nail first. And then I think the beautiful part about it is if you can nail with some degree of certainty financial freedom, and you can give yourself, quote unquote, enough to cover your bills for a period of time that is long enough that you will need it, so for decades, then it's a lot easier to think about balance. Really hard to get into balance when you work for somebody else, when you don't make enough money, or when you don't have a real plan for what to do going forward. And so that, to me, is the most straightforward path to wealth. And then you can ask yourself if you want balance after you've covered Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
So let's say somebody's listening to this podcast, they're like, Cody, I love what you just said. But here's the thing. I don't have any money. And at the same time, I've never run a business before. And who's going to sell me a profitable business? Like, what would you say? Where do they even begin?
So there's three different things there. If somebody says, hey, Cody, I don't have any money, so I can't buy a business, I would say, you're right. If you're in debt and you don't have any money, you can't go buy a business. Now, what could you do instead? You could go become the operator for somebody else. You could go find the deal for them. You could go run the business for them, and you could ask them for the capital to do it. So you're trading your sweat for their dollars. We teach how to do that. We teach something called rev share, profit share, sweat equity agreements. I think we have 21 different ways to do a deal without a ton of cash. And that's because if you ask anybody who has money, what is the number one thing that they need more of? It's not more money, actually. It's more competent humans. I need more operators in my business. I need more people who are willing to do the work. And so that is actually a really useful skill set if you're willing to do the work. Now, if you don't have experience for running a business, that's a lot easier of a thing to solve. If you're an accountant or an attorney, you know, we have a guy in our group, Rahun, who's bought 7 legal practices in the last year and a half. And he was an attorney listened to our stuff, was like, huh, I haven't ever run a legal firm before, but I've certainly worked in one. And why couldn't I just be in charge? And I might trust my decision-making power more than these other guys. And so we did it 5 times. And we've seen that again and again, roofing companies, HVAC companies, design agencies, marketing agencies. So I think experience is not underrated, but it is not the be-all end-all. What is more important is your pain tolerance. You know, can you take a certain degree of entrepreneurial pain? That's real. You know, it is real that you're going to have moments where you don't know what to do. You're going to have moments where you wonder where your next step's going to be, where you don't have enough money, where you wish you hadn't taken the jump. You will have that. But as long as you are the type of person with strong mental fortitude, I think you can run a small business.
So how does someone know? Because this is an area that I'm obviously very passionate about in terms of how difficult entrepreneurship truly is. I don't know that it's talked about enough, and it's glamorized in many ways, but when you're in the thick of it, when it's nighttime and weekends and the things that people don't see on social media, it's not for everyone. And I would argue in some ways, it's probably not for most people. How can you gauge if someone's built for this or not?
I've met very few entrepreneurs who ever go back and get a job. So what does that tell me? It tells me that we like to bitch about it being hard, but being in charge is almost always better than not being in charge. And so when you talk to other entrepreneurs, we like to bemoan the difficulty and say, God, our fucking employees don't get it, which is true often. But simultaneously, the only reason that some people can't run a business is because they're lazy, they don't want to actually do the work, or they can't have a high pain tolerance. It's rarely incompetence. You know, the stuff that we deal with, I don't think is that. I mean, I run laundromats and car washes and a media business. And like, none of this stuff is rocket science. I'm not creating robots. I'm not saving the world. What this is, though, is, you know, can you keep going after it gets hard? And like, I really think that that is the key. Now, can everybody run a business that does 7 figures, 8 figures, 9 figures? No, like mathematically not possible. But can a lot more people have ownership? Or maybe they're not the only owner, but with them and somebody else or 2 other people actually have skin in the game? Yeah, I think so. And I think it'd be better for all of us if more people did it, which is why I push on that a lot. Now, I think we have 3 levels in our community. So we have the entry level where people can come in if they're interested in buying a business. And then we have the owner circle for people who have bought a business. And then we have something we don't really talk about very often, which is for the very few people who are in 8-figure territory with a likelihood to get to 9. And that is really rare. Like, you know, those people are built different, 100%. But the middle tier, the ownership tier, looks a lot like the bottom tier. They're just more comfortable taking risk. And I don't see a huge intellectual difference between the two. I don't actually see a huge experiential difference between the two. It's really just, are they willing to take the risk or not? And does that risk crumble them?
When people start investing, or they, you know, decide that they like the idea of investing, most seem to be eager to get into a sexy business, right? Or a once in a lifetime opportunity like the Uber for this, or AI or machine learning, something like that in the title. But I know you encourage investing in, you know, so-called boring businesses. Why?
Anytime you do something, you want to pick the path that has the highest potential return to you and the lowest potential risk, if you can. If you know that walking down that dark alley to the left, where you kind of see a couple sketchy people in it, has a likelihood of something bad happening to you, or there's the well-lit main street, which is like clean, pretty straightforward, which one should you take? Well, obviously the one where there's less risk. And I think we don't think about that in business enough. We don't have the allegory of alleyway to main street. And that's what I think about. I think an alleyway is a lot like a startup. It is. There's a lot of questionable characters. It's really difficult, but maybe there's some treasure because lots of people don't go down there. Main Street, like, you're pretty comfortable walking down Main Street. It's normalized. There's nice lights and lots of people walking on it. And so because of that, we were told by Thoreau back in the day, if you're going to take 2 paths, take the path which is less traveled, right? It's actually kind of a dumb idea if you think about it from a survival perspective or even from a difficulty perspective. Why would you want to take the path less traveled? You know, that is literally why we built highways, so that we could go faster with a higher certainty of hitting our outcome at the expected time. And that's how I think about Main Street businesses. And so in our community, we have a database where you can basically go in and you can look at all the varying sectors and see how much do they sell for? How much money do they make? What are the risks in these businesses? You can talk to you know, our 8 facilitators who have all ran different industry-specific businesses. And so I kind of think that buying a business, building a business should be like dating. You want to go in and for the first, let's call it 3 to 6 months, you're really in an analysis mode. You're like, what do I want as a human? Not do I like this person, but like, do I like a woman or a man that looks like this? You know, do I want them to be funny? Do I want them to have money or not? Do I want them to be religious or not? You're kind of like figuring out who you are. That's what we call our deal box. So what's a good business for you? And then you're going out and saying, okay, now I know this is what a good business would be for me. Let's go talk to a bunch of businesses and see if one of them is one I want to date and then marry for a long time. And we obsess on that.
And when you're evaluating, let's say, a potential investment, what are some of the criteria that you're looking at, like to help you understand if this is going to be a potentially good investment versus, you know, a poor investment?
Well, there's 12 different parameters inside of our deal box. And some of the most important ones for me, for instance, are just, I want the business to have been around at least 3 to 5 years. I want a business that's profitable. I want a business that has a high likelihood of continuing to succeed. And how do I tell that? I want to see historical tax returns and profit and loss statements. Ideally, they kind of match and there's not a lot of variance from one year to another. I actually want a business that I can make sure I understand really easily. And then for my first business, if I buy the brick and mortar business, I want it to be located by me because I want to be able to control the outcome. Those are my personal first 5. But I think, you know, tools limit mistakes, right? So everything we do in our group is to say, how can we steal somebody else's 10,000 hours so that I can use their tools and limit the mistakes I might make if I use things based off of just gut. So I'm really big on checklists. If you're thinking about buying a business or getting into business and you don't have a checklist for keeping yourself honest, that's like one of my first things. And, you know, I mean, attorneys are all about this. You have a due diligence checklist. You know, you have a checklist to make sure your docs are correct. And almost everything where there is some risk, you want a checklist, just like a pilot taking off.
So what about on the side of the actual business owner who's selling their business? Like, what do you find some of the reasons why they would want to sell what could be seen as a healthy business, right? That it's been around a long time. There's infrastructure in place. There's, you know, a degree of recurring revenue. Cash flow is good. Why would they be interested in selling?
Yeah. Why do small business owners want to sell? There's basically something called the 7 D's. And so you have death, divorce, distress, disagreement, dullness. There's another one. It's like leaving. Let's call that like deviation. They leave their geographic area. So we call them the 7 horsemen of sales. So why would a small business owner sell? Because, you know, there's been a death in the family because they are getting divorced and they're being forced to divorce because they have a disagreement with their partner. And so one of them wants to sell out of it. Dull. They've been running the business for, you know, 5, 10 years. That's a long time. They're ready for something else. They have a business that they, you know, have in California, but they want to move to Florida because they're ready to make a change. And so these are the reasons why every single day people leave businesses. In fact, if you went to like any time I gave a speech, I always do this little thing where I ask people who here owns a business. I like, keep your hand up. I'm like, okay. And who here would sell their business right now at the right price and the right terms? And every hand stays up. There's like 2 or 3 that are probably early in their business buying journey that wouldn't sell. Almost every small business is for sale because of the thing we talked about in the beginning, which is there's some like low grade stress and pain that comes with running a small business. So for the most part, until you've made tens and tens and tens and tens and tens of millions of dollars, you'll sell just about any business for the right price and terms in order to get that amount. I think once you get to like Warren Buffett level, your businesses might legitimately not be for sale. But even for them, I bet at the right price they would be.
So for the, let's say the firm owners that are listening now, so we work with roughly 1,000 law firm owners. We coach them on their businesses. We, you know, one of the big things that we teach them is how to make that business investable. And we say that the value of your business is inversely proportional to its dependency on you. So the more dependent it is on that individual firm owner, the less valuable it is. What can a law firm owner do to make their business more valuable and more investable?
What are you trying to do? If you're trying to sell your law firm, or you'd like to sell your law firm, you need to figure out what sellers want or what buyers want, right? And so I think the first and foremost thing is you actually need to understand the flip side. What makes somebody want to buy a business? And once you understand how to buy a business, you will infinitely increase your ability to sell a business. So some of the smartest members of our group came in because they wanted to sell a business. And what do? They learned every single step of the buyer's journey. so that at the end of it, they go, okay, I now have a mindset of a buyer. And it is much easier to convince somebody of something when you speak their language and when you understand their wants. So I would say the best thing you could do is actually understand how to buy businesses if you want to sell one, because it's just the inverse. So the other thing that's interesting is if you understand what a buyer wants for a small business, you're going to see how they would negotiate with you, and you can preempt all of that. So that's the very first thing. It's the same exact thing, except inverse. You're right. We talk about the characteristics of a perfect recipe for sale business. So, you know, we have a YouTube video on this too, but essentially for every small business, the blueprint is the same to sell it. To your point, we want to make sure the business shows as much profit and revenue as humanly possible, obviously. We want to make sure the business looks like a business, not a job, meaning everything is standardized, processized, and you could hand over a business with a series of operating procedures. And then the third component, there's lots of things underneath the three of this. The third component is how much risk is in this business. And risk might be operational risk, right? That could certainly be one, aka if Michael leaves, is this podcast done? Well, most likely, yeah. So that's a huge risk. The risk could also be managerial risk. So the layer underneath Michael doesn't have incentive aligned structure for buyouts. And so because of that, if Michael sells, they will probably leave. The risk could also be concentration of clients, right? Is it just really one big vendor that is the only sponsor for this podcast? If so, if you go to sell, somebody might not want to take on that risk. So that third layer of overarching risk, I think, is really important after standard operating procedures and maximizing for revenue and profit. But number one is really profit and revenue, because people will forgive you a lot of things if you are highly profitable. People will not forgive you anything if you lose money, but you have a ton of standard operating procedures and you have less risk because you don't have concentrated clients and you have a managerial level. So if you're trying to find the 20% that drives the 80%, it's profit.
Yeah. I saw you do a video recently on like the differences between like a cash suck business versus a cash flow business. How would you define those?
Yeah. Well, when you go to sell a small business, remember, you're really selling an income stream. It's different when we get to the huge levels and there's lots of stuff that's more proprietary and maybe they're doing strategic acquisitions. But let's call it anything $10 million in revenue and below. And really, you could almost say $10 million in EBITDA and below, but we can deviate on that. When you get to selling a small business, all people really want is they're almost thinking about you like, I want to buy the income from this business. And because of that, a lot of businesses don't realize that they actually have to spend more than they make up front. And it's one of the funniest things I see when new buyers come in. They're like, this business makes X, and I have to explain float and what happens if you provide a service first and then get paid later, and how, in effect, you're a bank. You're a bank more than you're a business. You're doing loans to people all the time while you do work for them. And so the difference between a cash flow and a cash suck business is a cash flow business, you get paid up front, and then you provide the work. The cash suck business, you provide the work and then you get paid. And there's like five other characteristics under both of those, but to simplify, that's the idea.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure many of the law firms listening, at least the contingency fee ones, they're like, oh man, we're the cash suck business, right? Because they're doing the work and then they're getting paid off of, you know, whatever the case settles for based on a percentage of that fee, right? So with that comes a lot of expense. This is where managing that cash flow cycle becomes different, because it can be feast or famine, right? How would you suggest somebody navigate that? Like, do you recommend they diversify? And is this probably a good reason to invest in other businesses?
Yeah. I mean, my neighbor next door is a contingency attorney, like a very successful one. And there's a business model there, but I would argue that you have more of a job than you have a business at that stage, because you have no predictability into future revenues. And there are lots of ways that you could get around that. So for instance, let's say you are a contingency firm. How could you keep the firm that you have structurally, but change the business model in order to get cash upfront? Well, you could do actually a couple interesting things. You could restructure the cash payments so that when you get a bigness from an Exxon or something, or you win a big suit from Exxon or something, you actually structure payment plans where they pay you over time with an interest rate. Now, why would you want to do that? Why wouldn't you want to just take the money all up front? Well, it depends what your goal is, because if your business does $10 million in profit, let's say, and there is a component of that that could be seen as reoccurring revenue or future payments, well, that $10 million is actually valued at more like anywhere from 3 to 5 to 8x. So your $10 million is actually $30 or $80 million. And the interesting part about that is if you can structure your payments over time where the defendant has to pay you a fee, but they get to structure the payment out, and then you get to put that on their balance sheet with future payments. Well, that actually could turn you into a cash loan instead of a cash set business. You could also then manage your payroll better because you have future income earnings. You also then maybe won't spend as much upfront on things that you might have if you have really chunky payments. I mean, another thing that I would be trying to do in this case, and I know a lot of people don't, is have a percentage of the business that is retainer-based. So long-term contracts, there's lots of different ways to structure long-term contracts, but typically the more long-term the contract, the higher multiple you could sell it for later. And then certainly if you have a type of contract that is with the government, let's say, those contracts are worth more than with individuals. Corporations are worth more than individuals. So once you understand the hierarchy of recurring revenue, of future payments, and of non-transactional payments, you might restructure the way that you get paid, even though it would make less sense because you'd want to take the money all up front today.
And this is somewhat of a, I guess, like a meta question. I know Morgan Housel talks about this in The Psychology of Money, that, you know, making money and keeping money are really two different skill sets. So I'm glad you gave the example, because I said this a year ago and people looked at me like I was crazy. They said, look, Mike, I'm not a recurring business like you. I'm a law firm. And I say, look, if you get $1 million settlement, you can divide that by 12 and get $83,000 a month. And now you're reoccurring. They're like, well, why wouldn't I just take it all up front? I'm like, well, number one, you'd probably spend it all, right? And this is why you have these ups and downs when it comes to cash flow. But I'm curious as to your perspective in terms of, you know, making money versus keeping money and, let's say, being a good steward of money. What are your thoughts on in terms of those skill sets?
I think everything gets easier in a spreadsheet. So when you can see what the numbers actually mean to you, you can make a better decision. So for that person that wants to take $1 million settlement, I would just get into the practice of every single time that you get paid something, look at what the value is of the dollar today taken, and then have another level, which is what would the value of that dollar be if you were to sell the business? So give yourself an industry multiplier of like 3 to 5x. And when you do that, you'll realize, oh, I actually do want to have the discipline of structuring payments differently, because we're all selfish, greedy little apes running around trying to get ours, right? And so if you can make yourself see that perspective, then I think you can change your mindset. I think that's a lot of the reason why people say things like it's easier to make money than it is to keep it. I think that just comes down to we have spent our life learning how to earn it. So if you're an attorney, what are you really good at doing? Well, you're good at winning lawsuits and you're good at bringing in earnings. You are not by trade a financial advisor or investment manager. You haven't spent your life in pursuit of the keeping. You've spent your life in pursuit of the earning. And so, of course, you're better at one than the other. But you have to build up that simultaneous habit of the other thing. And so that's why I also think it's really useful to have this mentality of, what if I die? What if I get hospitalized for a long time? What if I can't work for some reason or another for a long period of time? And if I am in that instance, will I have income generating revenue for me? And it's something that keeps me up at night in any business that I don't have that. And so when you flip your mindset to that, then it's not really a skill keeping it. It's just an attention problem. We don't give enough attention to keeping it. We give a lot of attention to making it.
And I want to shift gears just a little bit. I've heard you talk about this before on other podcasts. You mentioned it even earlier in terms of, you know, a lot of small businesses, they work with their partner or their spouse. My wife and I have been working in this business for over a decade. I understand that you and your husband, you've done some work together. In your view, when this comes together, it seems to be a beautiful thing. And a lot of our listeners, they work with their spouse or their partner. What's the recipe for success? How do people make this work?
I don't know, because I've never not done it. So I think perhaps part of being in a strong relationship over time is just letting the other person be who they are and you being who you are and not trying overly to change that person. Most of the misery happens in our attempts to change the other person from who they are. And so, you know, when it comes to my husband and I working together, we're both pretty self-aware of what we're good and bad at, and we try to let each other live in the lane where our zone of genius is. I don't make Chris go and hang out at family outings that he doesn't want to be at. He doesn't make me go and watch his games with the boys. in our business, if I tell him I don't want to be on a call, I'm just not on it. And the same for him. And so I think as long as the person that you've chosen, you two are morally aligned and you are outcome aligned, and you are both willing to do what it takes to both be moral as you've defined it and be successful as you've defined it, then lots of the things in the middle don't matter. But I think a lot of the problems, people go, well, how do I get my wife to be more into this? Like, I have no idea. I don't think you do. You just pick a wife that is into it, or you find things that your wife are into and you allow her or him to do it. That's my only answer, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say at that point, it's too late, because this isn't just like success in business. It's probably overall success and happiness in life, being with somebody that you're aligned with. So
yeah.
One of the things I'm always curious about is that I find the best leaders are open to changing their mind. They're open to a new perspective once they receive new information, new evidence. What's something that you've recently changed your mind on?
Well, actually, we have this report that just came out. It's the state of 2024 State of the SMB report. And it was fascinating. We did a study looking at hundreds of small business buyers and hundreds of small business owners. And I didn't realize how many things I had a bias on that were just basically not true. And so I think you can get it at contrarianthinking.co/2024report. And one of the things that I've changed my mind on recently is that I thought that people buying small businesses with seller financing was absolutely doable, but not as normal. And what I found in this report, and you can see it in the data, is that the number historically was 60% of all small businesses that are bought with some percentage of seller financing. Our people are doing like 80 to 90% of their deals with some percentage of seller financing. It doesn't mean they're going to seller finance the whole thing. So that actually surprised me. It's totally counter to the narrative. And I was wrong. I thought 40 to 60% and somewhere like maybe you could get up to 40 to 50% seller financing for a deal. And then I started talking to our members and they're like, no, I got a deal, this $8 million deal, and I got it seller finance. And so that surprised me. I also, in this report, it's just top of mind, so I might have recency bias, but I was really surprised by the difference in opinion. So when you read the report, you'll see small business owners have never been more negative than they are right now. Like, they're negative. They think the world is really tough. And then simultaneously, they're selling their businesses and their businesses are more profitable than they've been the last 5 years. So like, their narrative of how they feel versus what the market is telling them their businesses are worth and the profitability of their businesses are totally deviated, which I thought was fascinating too. And so that's why I always go back to the numbers, because we can't trust these little squirrel brains in here that make us feel certain things based on emotion. And instead, we have to go back to that idea of, you know, tools limit mistakes. So go to the data and look at it. And then you might shock yourself with what you're capable of doing or what the truth is when you're able to take emotions out of it.
Love it. Cody, as we come to a close, this being the Game Changing Attorney podcast, what does being a game changer mean to you?
In the U.S., we have a nation of consumers, of complainers, and of victims. And it's really not everybody's fault. We were sold all of these lies and false narratives about we needed to go get an education and then go $100,000 in debt. We needed to work in big tech and corporations, so then we needed to get MBAs and then we'd be safe. Marriage is actually hard. We shouldn't do it. Not all of us can be an owner. It's just for those at the really, really top. And I think we've been sold a bag of goods. I think we have, however, bought into it, and that is our fault. Even though we've been sold a bag of lies, we should have seen through it. And so a game changer to me is the type of human who realizes that most of the things you want in life are actually possible and then takes action to achieve them. And the worst thing that you could have happen is at the end of the day, you get to the pearly gates, you see whatever your version of God is, and you think, huh, I could have done all of those things. And instead, this is what I did with it. And that is totally in your ability to control, and a tragedy for you and this country if more of us don't step up to the plate. And so I'm very, very thankful for people like you who have a podcast like this and people who listen to podcasts like this, because we need more game changers.
I want to give a huge thank you to Cody Sanchez for taking the time to join us on the Game Changing Attorney podcast. If you found this episode valuable, here are three free ways that I can help you grow your law firm. Number one, Download the first chapter of my book absolutely free at gamechangingattorney.com. Number two, you can shoot me a text at 404-531-7691 and I'll answer any question that you've got for me. And finally, number three, if you can leave this podcast a five-star review, it'll help us gain access to more influential thought leaders and bring their lessons learned here to you. For more information on our interview with Cody Sanchez, see the show notes for this episode in your podcast app or visit legalpodcast.com.